Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Monday, the 2nd of September, these are our main stories. As we record this podcast, a powerful hurricane is lashing the northwestern Bahamas, sweeping away cars and destroying buildings. The government of Argentina introduces moves to shore up its currency, raising more concerns about the economy. Exit polls after two state elections in Germany suggest the major parties have withstood a strong challenge from right-wing populists. Also in this podcast...
This is my third lesson. He's leaning over my shoulder. I'm trying to keep him up, but he keeps falling down.
How a trainee pilot lands a plane after his instructor collapses during his first lesson.
Well, this young man, people call him a hero, but I can tell you what, he's damn good.
They've never seen anything like it in the Bahamas. The 295-kilometre-an-hour winds, the 4 to 7 metre-high wall of water known as the storm surge that swept away cars and destroyed some buildings. Hurricane Dorian has made landfall. At a news briefing before the storm arrived, the Prime Minister, Hubert Minnis, addressed those who had refused to follow evacuation orders.
This is a deadly storm and a monster storm. On two previous occasions, I've asked Bahamians to leave the Keys. Many had not heeded my warning. Many had remained behind. And still there are individuals within the western area who still refuse to leave. I can only say to them, this is not the last time they will hear my voice. And may God be with them.
But for whatever reason, some people were unwilling or unable to leave. Already on social media, there are dramatic images and video filmed by people stuck in buildings, like this woman, Jutta Clavi, on the island of Abaco.
Please pray for us. Please pray for us, everyone. Please pray for us. Me and my baby, everyone that stay in the apartment building, we stuck right here. Please pray for us. My baby is only 4 months old. Please pray for us. I'm begging, I pray for us. The apartment building, as we stay in, the whole roof came off.
Well, she was transmitting live as she stood on the external staircase to her building, water swirling beneath her, being buffeted by the wind. The BBC's Ali McBall is a couple of hundred kilometres to the west in Palm Beach, Florida.
There is a preparation going on here. It seems still very calm in Florida, but a lot of people have boarded up their properties and moved away. And the difficult thing here was exactly what was difficult over the Bahamas. Because there has been such a dramatic shift in the path of this hurricane over the last couple of days, it's been very difficult to know where to evacuate and where was going to be safe. And so you've seen that a lot of people are stuck in Abaco, and we are, as you rightly say, getting the first pictures out of Abaco of, you know, boats that have been thrown onto land. And because that storm surge that you talked about was in many cases higher than large parts of the island itself, it means that huge areas are submerged. We can see the tops of homes that are surrounded entirely with water. And that hurricane is now going on to Grand Bahama, where again there are going to be issues that have been predicted in terms of storm surges, but with much bigger population centres like Freeport, the second biggest city in the Bahamas.
And darling, we're hearing from the National Hurricane Centre that these conditions in the Bahamas are going to be there for 30 hours or more. Extremely difficult to mount a rescue operation, emergency operation during that time period.
Yes, because it's a huge storm. I talked about how it had shifted dramatically. It's also changed in size and strength dramatically over the last couple of days, which is why it was categorized as a Category 5 hurricane. But while it is large in size and while the wind speeds around it are extremely fast, it is moving over land very slowly at around 8 miles an hour. So it is going across these areas and causing a lot of destruction with great wind speed, but over a long period of time.
That was Ali McBall. Well, Phil Klotzbach studies hurricanes like Dorian, he told the BBC's Julian Marshall that it will continue to move relatively slowly.
Hurricanes move kind of like a pebble in a stream. And so basically what is occurring with Dorian is that there's not really any systems in the mid-latitudes to push it very quickly in any one direction. And so it is going to be a very, very slow moving event, which means a very long duration event of extremely high winds, heavy rain, and some storm surge as well.
And the fact that it is moving so slowly and is so intense means the maximum amount of damage, does it?
Correct, yes. By the fact that it's moving very, very slowly, that means that these areas where the eye is going to be passing directly over are going to be experiencing extremely heavy winds for a long duration of time. Right now, the storm, in terms of how far the winds extend out from the center of the storm, in terms of the hurricane force winds, is fairly small. But when the storm is only moving at 6 to 8 kilometers an hour, that's still going to mean quite a few hours of hurricane force winds for where the center of the circulation goes directly over.
And because the hurricane is moving so slowly at the moment anyway, does it therefore make it more difficult to forecast where it's going next?
To a degree, yes, because it's moving so slowly, that means that it's just further in time into the future when the storm is likely going to turn. So there is a lot of uncertainty as to exactly when the storm will make the predicted turn to the north. If it goes further to the west, then its impacts potentially on Florida could be much higher because the center of the storm potentially track very close to the coast or even make landfall. Whereas if it turns to the north a little bit further to the east, the storm could actually mostly miss Florida and then potentially also miss the Carolinas and Georgia, which is the other area of concern, as the entire southeastern United States certainly could still see very, very significant impacts from Dorian.
And do hurricanes always lose force when they make landfall?
Yes, they do, because basically hurricanes' source of energy is warm ocean water. So when it runs out of that warm ocean water, it's basically running out of fuel. So it does weaken as it makes landfall. Now, if storm making landfall on a very small island like in the Bahamas with very little topography, does very, very little to the hurricane. But if it were to make landfall, say, in Florida or something like that, it would weaken much quicker because obviously Florida is a large landmass as opposed to the islands of the Bahamas, which generally are very small.
Year on year, are we seeing more and more powerful hurricanes?
Well, the last few years, we've seen extremely powerful hurricanes, but especially for the U.S., we went from 2006 to 2016, 11 years, and we didn't have any major hurricanes hit the continental U.S. In general, when it comes to kind of climate change's impacts on hurricanes, the observational data shows that the hurricanes are getting a bit stronger. The question is, some of that may be just due to improved observations, but in the future, the models generally say that we should expect maybe not more hurricanes, but slightly stronger hurricanes. In addition to that, likely with sea level rise, we're going to see increased inundation from storms. Basically, when the storm surge comes on shore, if the sea level is higher, you're going to see the water go further inland. Also in the future, given the warmer atmosphere, we should expect to see more rain from the storm. So there's certainly significant impacts we will see from climate change. And certainly we're seeing more damage from these storms simply just due to the fact that there's more people and more stuff along the coastline, especially the continental U.S. has been a big shift to the south and to the southeast U.S. So a lot of people living in harm's way that, say, weren't there 50 years ago.
That was Phil Klotzbach from the Department of Atmospheric Science at Colorado State University. A senior aid worker in Yemen has spoken of his shock at what he saw at the scene of a Saudi-led coalition airstrike on a prison. Houthi rebels have claimed that at least 50 of their prisoners were killed in airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition. And that coalition said it had targeted a rebel site storing drones and missiles. Well, the International Committee of the Red Cross reached the scene in the western city of Damar after the airstrikes. Franz Rokenstein is head of the ICRC in Yemen, and he was there.
You know, I saw a building that was completely collapsed.
You know, I saw a building that was completely collapsed. And in that building, there were many detainees. When we visited last time, there were 170 detainees there. And this building had completely collapsed. So it was full of dead bodies, full of body parts. We found out later on that around 30 had been evacuated via surrounding hospitals to treat the wounded. The rest have very probably been killed. So we're counting more than 100 people killed due to this airstrike.
And the ICRC had already established that this site was a detention centre.
Exactly. It was a detention facility.
Exactly. It was a detention facility that we had visited several times since last month or since the beginning of the year. It was a place where we also now wanted to invest in increased water and sanitation facilities. So it was a place that was taken care of by the ICRC. And when I came this morning, it was completely shocking and saddening to see all these detainees dead. We've started to evacuate the bodies from these collapsed buildings. But this will be work that will last for 2 or 3 days.
It appears that the Saudi-led coalition, in saying that they have targeted a military position in Derma that stores drones and missiles, are not telling the truth.
I can really only see what I have seen.
Now, I can only really say what I have seen, and that is exactly that building that has been used for quite some time for detention purposes was targeted. I think it's the task of every warring party to take the necessary precautions to ensure that the target is a military one. I hope that inquiries into this terrible incident will elucidate what really has happened and motivated these Saudi airstrikes.
Were you able to speak to any survivors? Were you able to gain any idea of what had happened?
I spoke to some of the survivors in the hospital.
And they said just around midnight there were these air attacks, which came very suddenly and very unexpectedly, of course. Some people were still in the washing room. Many people had been taking a bath or a shower at that time. People are shocked. There have been few survivors, and some of the survivors are in very bad shape.
Will you be conducting autopsies on the bodies to see how these people died?
What we will do is to collect the body parts.
What we will do is collect the body parts, put them together to identify the faces and number them as well. And then we will deposit them in a morgue for the time being, and later maybe a temporary burial. But we'll also try to look for the families, because every family has the right to know.
These detainees were mainly government soldiers, were they?
Probably part of them government soldiers.
Probably some of them were government soldiers or also combatants of associated groups. It's a bit of a mixed bag, but they were clearly participating in the hostilities in Yemen.
That was Franz Rauchenstein of the ICRC talking to the BBC's Julian Marshall. And because of the bad quality of the line, as you heard, we had to voice over the interview. Argentina used to be one of the world's richest nations, but decades of on-off recessions, IMF bailouts and loan defaults have put paid to that. 3 years ago, President Mauricio Macri came to power promising to reverse the slide. But the country's currency, the peso, has lost a quarter of its value since Mr. Macri did much worse than expected in a primary poll last month, suggesting he's likely to be ousted in elections in October. Now his government has introduced restrictions in an attempt to prop up the currency. Daniel Galas is our Latin America business correspondent based in Sao Paulo.
What the government is doing is restricting the amount of dollars that both people and companies can buy. For instance, an ordinary Argentinian, he can only buy up to $10,000 per month. And what they're trying to do is desperately avoid people to exchange their pesos for dollars, which is largely the driving force behind Argentina's economic crisis this month. The currency is losing a lot of value and people don't trust the value of their currency anymore. So they're seeking dollars and that's what the government is trying to curb now.
I mean, the opposition puts the blame for the whole situation at the government still, doesn't it?
And the government blames the opposition who were in power before. So it's all a big political debate, like in many countries. But basically, they blame the government for failing to fulfill all of its promises, which was to tackle inflation, to cut spending, and to get people to trust again Argentina as a sound economy. It's one of the world's 20 greatest economies, but people just don't believe in it anymore, and they're taking their money out of the country.
That was Daniel Galas. You're listening to the Global News Podcast. Still to come, attracting the right type of tourists to Amsterdam. A student pilot has made a dramatic emergency landing at Perth's Jandakot Airport during his first lesson in a two-seater aircraft after his instructor collapsed mid-flight. Max Sylvester called air traffic control just over an hour into his lesson after realising he was alone at the controls of the small Cessna.
Tango Foxtrot Romeo, do you know how to operate the aeroplane?
Very, very light. This is my first lesson.
structure at the moment? Are they unconscious?
He's leaning over my shoulder. I'm trying to keep him up, but he keeps falling down.
The first thing we're going to do is make sure that the wings stay level and that you keep consistent speed and consistent altitude. Can you tell me how your instructor's doing at the moment? How's he looking?
No, he hasn't woken up. I've just tried to lift his head back up just to check to see how he's going, but he's not responding.
Your instructor communicating at all?
No, he's not.
Tango Foxtrot Romeo, that's okay. Your job right now is just keep focusing on that aircraft as best you can. Secondary to that is just to keep his head upright and his body upright in the seat. But we're going to get you on the ground very soon and get both of you guys on the ground safely. You're doing really, really well. You're doing an amazing job.
Yeah, well, my flight instructor did say that I was the best student he's had.
Well, we definitely have a story to tell at the end of this time.
Wow, extraordinary presence of mind to have a bit of humour there as well. Well, Chuck McElwee is the owner of Air Australia International, which employs the pilot. He told Julian Marshall what happened when the pilot collapsed on Max.
Max moved him slightly out of the way, you know, so he could handle the controls. But the instructor came in and out of consciousness, but Max was cool enough to say, look, I've got it. And the people in the tower said, they've got it. And then he pass out again.
And how is the instructor now?
He's still in a hospital. They're doing CAT scans and CT scans, but he's conscious. He's talking to people. It appears that it was some sort of seizure, but nobody has put a name to it yet or anything like that. He has had no problems in the past. He has the current medical, and, you know, as far as we're concerned, he was at the time of the flight, he was completely fit.
And how long was it before the situation arose, that is to say, you were alerted that the instructor had passed out and the plane landed on the ground?
Oh, it was about 45 minutes. The only real concern we had was it was late in the day, and the later it gets, the closer to night you get. But the tower did a wonderful job, and they put everybody in holding away from the airport. So they did all the things they needed to do. Plus, our guy was up there keeping them informed of the capabilities of the airplane and what he knew of the student.
45 minutes seems an awfully long time, a nail-bitingly length of time.
Let's just say I was a little tense, but it wasn't disastrous or anything like that. The young man had his act together, and he was very, very professional. If you listen to our live ATC Perth or Jandakot, you'll hear he is actually a pretty switched on young man.
And he gets a certificate just for this, does he?
Well, I gave him one. They don't normally get a certificate, but I think I can make an exception this once. He went solo kind of impromptu, and he did really well. We have a saying in aviation, any landing you can walk away from is a good landing. Any landing you do and we can use the plane again is a great landing. Well, he had a great landing because there was nothing wrong with the airplane. The only real problem that we had was that his wife and three children, smallish children, like about 3.5, 4, they were all there in the lobby while all this was taking place. So we're more concerned about them than actually him, because it was really obviously he was settled and he was going to be able to handle this.
But his wife and children were clearly very, very anxious.
Well, the children are so young, they didn't know what was happening. Wife was a rock, though. She held it together for her kids. I'll tell you what, she was as steady as you can get. But you could see she was worried.
And did you allow Max's wife to speak to him?
No, he had his hands full, so we knew we were going to get him down. We work real hard to make sure every landing turns out like this one, regardless of the circumstances. And so we don't want to divert their thinking into other subjects. We got him focused, he stayed focused, and he touched down. If you talk to any pilot anywhere in the world, every one of them thinks one day somebody's going to walk up and in the back of the cabin, if they're in an airline, says, does anybody know how to fly? And he goes up and saves the day. Well, this young man, he's clearly had his act together and he landed the plane. And people call him a hero, but I can tell you what, he's damn good.
That was Chuck McElwee of Air Australia International. In Germany, elections in two eastern states have seen strong gains for the far-right Alternative for Deutschland, the AfD. but the party failed to become the strongest force in both Saxony and Brandenburg. Despite losing votes, Angela Merkel's CDU remains the largest party in Saxony, as do the Social Democrats in Brandenburg. Our correspondent in Berlin, Damian McGuinness, has this assessment.
There will be a sigh of relief in Berlin tonight. Decent results for Angela Merkel's Conservatives in Saxony. Her party looks set to stay in power there. And a narrow victory in Brandenburg for the centre-left Social Democrats, Mrs. Merkel's coalition partners in national government. They worried they might lose to the right-wing populist AfD. That could have sparked a crisis. So, not quite jubilation for Germany's two main parties, but a feeling that they've dodged a bullet and managed to fend off the populists. The friendly Saxony has won, said Saxony's conservative leader, a clear reference to the AfD, which is accused of stirring resentment and xenophobia. But it was a close call. The AfD is popular in both states and ran an effective campaign. The party tapped into disaffection in former communist Eastern Germany, where wages and pensions are lower than in the West. The AfD even co-opted phrases from the dissident movement that brought down the Berlin Wall 30 years ago. As a result, the party has made big gains in both states. But the AfD had hoped to win the most votes. That could have paved the way to possible future coalitions. That didn't happen. So the AfD has done well. It hasn't done quite as well as some hoped.
Damian McGuinness in Berlin. Here in Britain, Matthew Johnston has just completed jury service. It's what thousands of citizens do each year, sitting in judgment on their fellow citizens who are standing trial for a crime. But what makes Mr. Johnston so different is that he's profoundly deaf. Deaf people have previously been denied the opportunity to serve on juries in the UK because many rely on sign language. And English and Welsh law prohibits the presence in the jury deliberation room of anyone except the 12 sworn jurors. Although born profoundly deaf, Mr. Johnston has learnt to speak, can lip-read, and a cochlear implant has given him limited hearing. Julian Marshall asked him about his childhood.
Hard work, because my parents are hearing, but they want me to speak rather than to sign, because it's a lot easier to learn to sign than to learn to speak. So you can imagine I would have a very short-tempered, frustrated little boy.
Let's fast forward about 45 years, okay. And you get a summons for jury service. What's your first reaction?
I was called up in January, and I say to them, I'd love to do it, but I need sonography, which are what you call human capacity. And they say, oh, we didn't know you're deaf. And I say, that's fine, but can I have some? And they say, well, we don't have the funding. And I say, well, can we apply for funding? And they say, we will have to speak to the judge. They came back to me and say, great news, Matthew. The judge agreed to provide funding. Do you need a signer? And I didn't know. Could I would aware that you can't have a 13 person in the jury. And I said, no, I don't need one. It might be helpful if I come to see you, meet you, then you can see for yourself whether I can lip read or not. So I met them, I could lip read them, so they can see that was an issue. And they also took me to the deliberation room, and it's a big, large round table, which is perfect lip reading. With a round table, you can see everybody. And I say, it'd be fine.
Was it difficult to follow the court proceedings? After all, there are quite a few people in that courtroom, prosecution, defence lawyers, not necessarily facing in your direction.
It wasn't an issue at all. I would petition in a really good petition in the front row, and I could see the judge, I could see the barrister, and I could see the witness box. So no, I didn't have an issue at all. I could actually follow quite a lot of the computation, but I didn't need the subtitle because I did miss some of the computation. Yeah, it would be a bright room. Yeah, I would play the part.
But I would imagine that when the jury retired to deliberate, that was more of a challenge. You've spoken about a round table, but jury deliberations are all about arguments. Absolutely. And they can become quite chaotic.
Absolutely. And in the first couple of days, the usher were very nervy. But after a couple of days, it calmed down and it became normal. The way we were retired to the deliberation. So at the table, we started and I said to them, as you all know that I'm deaf, I'd be very grateful if you could look at me when you talk. And it'd be very helpful if you talk one at a time. Otherwise, it'd be like a tennis match. And it'd be really hard for me to move my head, you know, left to right. And they all obliged. And then one chap said to me, you know what, Matthew? You should be the foreman. And I say, no, I didn't ask to be a foreman. And everybody say, no, we all agree. You should be the foreman, Matthew. No question. And at that point, I did become quite emotional because I realised that they had confidence in me. And I realised that my destiny is not an issue.
And arguably because of your requirements as a profoundly deaf person and the fact that you asked the jurors to speak one by one, you had a calming influence on the proceedings.
Absolutely. And they raised their hand up every time they wanted to talk. And I would sort of look at them, say, you're Nick, and so on. And actually, it was a very controlled environment, as you can imagine, and nobody overtalked each other. I followed every conversation, and we all came up with a verdict. We gave the verdict. I got back to the courtroom. The judge says, Mr. Foreman, stand up. Have you written a verdict? Yes. Was it unanimous? Yes. Not guilty, guilty. And guilty. I felt a big weight on my shoulder, as you can imagine. I felt an honour, a privilege.
That was Matthew Johnston. In some of the world's most visited cities, the tide of tourism has started to make life rather difficult. It's not just a problem for the people who live in places like Venice and Dubrovnik. There's less and less point in being a tourist if you find that your presence is destroying the beauty that you've come to see. Governments have always liked tourism. It creates jobs and brings in foreign currency. But the government in the Netherlands is starting to wonder if it should discourage some visitors from Amsterdam and divert them instead to quieter parts of the country. Our Europe correspondent, Kevin Connolly, failed to take the hint and travelled to the city to find out more.
Snaking along the narrow alleyways of tall, brightly painted townhouses, under the crowded canal bridges and across the limpid waterways, the opening notes of the Amsterdam Grachten Festival, a musical salute to the canal system, which provides the neural wiring of Amsterdam. It couldn't be any more Dutch, but it's something more too, a kind of fanfare for traditional tourism.
The one thing we say is that we bring the best in classical music and jazz from all continents.
Marie-Luce Bray is the breezy, energetic musical polymath who's put the programme together.
I think we cater to everyone who's in Amsterdam, both the inhabitants and the visitors. The concerts take place in all sorts of crazy locations.
For decades now, everyone's assumed that tourism is just a good thing. But it's the Dutch who are starting to think the unthinkable about tourism. That maybe you can have too much of it, or at least too much of the wrong sort. British stag parties, for example, spend money on beer, but they might put other visitors off. So the Dutch want to do more to attract the right kind of tourists, and they also want you to think about going somewhere other than overcrowded Amsterdam. Persuading tourists to go elsewhere won't be easy. We're outside Anne Frank's house, which of course is in Amsterdam. There's a long queue of foreign visitors. So if the Dutch authorities ever do succeed in gently shooing us away from Amsterdam, where are we going to end up? One possible answer is here, the town of Zwolle. Enter Bertrand Maas, manager of the Van der Zinde Brewer and Bookshop, and volunteer, unpaid, tourist officer.
I think we have a nice tour with a boat in the canals, because when you walk through the city, well, that's okay, but when you do it on a boat, that's really spectacular.
When you add together the environmental cost of tourism and that understandable lack of appetite for watching foreign stag parties urinating in the street, you can understand why Amsterdam wants to discourage some visitors and divert others. But watching this empty merry-go-round rotating miserably in the centre of Zwolle in the driving rain does rather make you wonder exactly what tourism is going to feel like in the future when all these changes come to pass.
That was Kevin Connolly in Amsterdam. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.